Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Mark Gilbert. He is the bureau chief for Bloomberg News in London and author of the new book, Complicit: How Greed and Collusion Made the Credit Crisis Unstoppable. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So there's been a lot written and broadcast about the banking and credit crises, and it continues to be hard for people to understand. So I thought maybe we could start with some basics. You wrote in your book that a lot of the money that was there and then disappeared didn't really exist in the first place. And so I wondered if you could just tell us, it sounds like a silly question, but what is money?
Well, let me give you an analogy. If you drive a car, you buy an insurance policy on that car, and you pay a regular premium to the insurance company on the basis that if something goes wrong with your car, then you'll be able to claim on the policy and kind of rescue yourself from the situation. What happened in the credit boom was that banks were writing insurance policies on cars that didn't exist for people who didn't even have a driving license, purely for the fun, as it were, to be able to buy and sell those policies, to collect them together, to form pools of insurance policies, and to create securities called derivatives. Now, the car didn't exist, the drivers didn't exist, but you could still write the policy, you could still collect the premiums, and you'd basically be making a bet on how many car crashes there would be, even though you didn't have a car. So you've invented risk, you've sort of invented money, if you like, by making that kind of gamble. They're like IOUs, but very sophisticated, very complicated, got a lot of documentation, a lot of legal structure around them. But it was basically creating risk out of thin air and making money out of nothing. So one of the aspects of the credit crisis that's kind of hard to get your head around is this idea of virtual money. But that's how it was done. You write a contract based on an underlying risk, and then you buy and sell those bets, those IOUs, as a way of making the market. So that's what I mean when I say in the book that the money didn't really exist in the first place.
The financial industry is based on money, and what I've been wondering is this. Does money have to be based on something real? So, for example, you take ore out of the ground, you make steel, or you raise a cow, you sell its milk, or you grow apples and you make applesauce and you sell that. There's some physical reality. Is that or is that not the root of all money?
No, it doesn't need to be. For instance, at the moment, you can go online to a lot of video games and you can buy and sell orc hammers or swords or armor, and you can have a virtual currency within that game world, which to all intents and purposes is still useful. It's still a medium of exchange. It still allows you to buy and sell things, and you can earn more currency by doing tasks within the game. But it's in no sense real. Now, there are those who argue that one of the things that might be needed in finance is a return to the gold standard, where all money is backed by something solid like gold from the ground. But there's not much sign of that catching on as an idea. It's certainly how money used to be, but there doesn't seem to be any philosophical objection to what's called a fiat currency, where it's simply, as long as I agree and you agree what the value of a dollar is, and we agree what goods and services we're going to buy and sell for it, then that dollar is just fine and dandy as it is, without needing anything physical backing it, the same as our currency does in the video game world.
So what is a bubble? Let's maybe use the real estate market as an example.
Very hard to define, but you know it when it bursts. A bubble is generally when the price of something, and it can be housing, it can be art, it can be fine wine, when it's got out of touch with reality in some sense, whereby the thing that you're buying and selling, you're not really valuing. You're not buying a house because you want to live in it. You're buying a condo in Florida because you think you can flip it to the next person for a profit, the kind of greater fool theory from economics. So we tend to think of bubbles when we're watching market prices as prices that have got unhinged from some underlying value. Now, what's a house worth? Well, it's partly worth what someone will pay for it, but it's also partly worth what someone can afford to pay for it. And one of the things that we saw in the housing boom was this detaching of house values from historical norms, which is often a good guide, but also from ability to pay, which we usually measure by sizes of mortgages versus people's annual incomes. Once those ratios start to get out of whack, then you probably have a fairly good alarm bell that you're watching the bubble grow.
So the price of a house is not only what somebody would... Say that again. I mean, what makes a house... What determines the value of a house, and what makes it overvalued?
Well, it's partly what someone's willing to pay, but if every house in your area began to cost as much as 10 times your annual income for a mortgage, then the chances are you're not going to find someone willing to lend that money to you at 10 times your annual income. So houses become detached from reality. They just become too expensive for anyone to buy them. Now, what we saw during the housing boom was exactly that. As house prices grew faster than incomes did, then the amount of money you had to borrow to be able to afford to buy a house became a bigger and bigger multiple of your income. And that's when the lenders relaxed their standards too much, and you ended up borrowing more money than you could comfortably afford to pay back, even under low interest rates. So that's what I mean when I say they get detached from reality. If the amount you have to borrow to buy a house is just too far away from what your annual income is, you're never going to be able to afford those loans.
So what was the impetus on the part of lenders for making those loans when they knew that they couldn't be repaid?
Well, we had a couple of things going on. One was that the Fed had kept interest rates low for a long time, so money was cheap. You'd had a house price acceleration, so there was this sort of underlying belief that house prices could only go up. But the main driver was a brand of financial innovation called securitization, which basically meant I lent you the money for your house, but then I took that contract and I sold it to someone else. And so I didn't have any skin in the game. I didn't really care that when the teaser rates ran out in 2, 3, or 4 years' time, that you wouldn't be able to make your monthly payments, because it wasn't going to be my problem. It was going to be somebody else's problem. I'd already made my fee for arranging the mortgage. I'd probably made a little bit of money by selling it on as well. And so halfway around the world, someone else was going to have to deal with the blowback from your inability to meet your mortgage payments. I was still going to make my bonus and my income. And that was basically at the root of the problem. The securitization process meant there was a divorcing of lenders from borrowers, and that's what meant that lending standards collapsed. And that's where you ended up with ninja loans, no income, no job, and no assets, liar loans, where people weren't even giving the right documentation for how much money they earned. And that was the sort of the seeds of the housing bubble.
Now, these loans were, as probably many people have read about, as you say, repackaged and sliced up in all sorts of ways and resold. If everybody who had bought a house, had they been able to pay for it, would all of this have happened? I mean, was this whole thing really based on poor people getting loans that they shouldn't have gotten?
It was, and it sounds a little bit weird, but at the very base of this inverted pyramid, U.S. home ownership had been 64% for years and years and years. 64% of the population were economically stable enough to afford their own house. They didn't need to rent. What happened in the housing boom was that rose to almost 70%. Those last 5, 6% of people were the ones who were seduced by these low teaser rates. They were somewhat pillaged, I think, by the lenders. They were lured into taking loans they couldn't afford. And so you had economically unstable people being dragged into home ownership, everyone's dream, and they just weren't able to make those payments. Now, that pile of mortgages, they were the least safe, the least reliable of all of the mortgage pool. They were also the freshest mortgages. They were brand new. And they were the ones that were easily traded. So they were the ones that formed the basis of these new securitized bond issues that were bought and sold all around the world, and the ones that went sour. It really was that last 5% of the U.S. home ownership market that led to the credit crisis, that sowed the seeds of the destruction that we saw in finance.
Do you have a sense of what the actual numbers were? Okay, so 5% of people who couldn't afford it defaulted on their loans. Before you get into these derivatives and securitized loan bundles, things that are very hard to understand, even though, you know, we read your book and so on, for people who aren't in that world, they're hard to understand. But just the loans themselves, do we have a number of what those defaulted loans were worth before they were repackaged and resold?
Well, the numbers were known to everyone in the mortgage industry, but the numbers didn't really matter. Well, it was like riding a bicycle. You had to keep the product churning. You had to keep the wheels going around. Otherwise, you would fall over. So the behavior that we saw on behalf of the mortgage lenders was that everyone was in a race to the bottom. Everyone was busy trying to make new loans so that they could keep the pipeline going because they didn't really have any money to make the loans in the first place. When I was making a mortgage for you to buy your house, I was relying on selling the mortgage that I made yesterday to get back that money to be able to lend it to you. So you had sort of this paper chase, a kind of chain letter of needing to sell yesterday's mortgage to be able to fund tomorrow's mortgage. And that's why it accelerated so quickly. And that's why when the end came, it turned out the mortgage lenders were all depending upon borrowing themselves to make this money out to the mortgage market. And when that ability to sell old mortgages dried up, they could no longer make fresh mortgages, and the whole game collapsed.
So it's really, I mean, there's different analogies for it. One is borrowing Peter to pay Paul. Another is just a Ponzi scheme.
Borrowing Peter to pay Paul, certainly. You've never been able to do this before. You've never had a global market whereby you could make a loan to someone in Florida so they could buy a condo, and then you could then turn that loan into a pool of similar mortgages and sell them to an investor in China and get your money today so that you could then go make a new mortgage the very next day. Globalization meant that markets were seamless and these pools of capital were available. Instant sort of technology meant that information was flowing faster than ever, so that helped develop the market as well. And investors really did start to think that derivatives were the savior of their returns, that these higher-yielding securities in a low-inflation, low-interest-rate environment were what was going to juice their returns and turn their own bonuses, and that they understood the products. They knew what a mortgage was, so how difficult could it be? And, hey, the housing market was always going to go up, so everyone was going to be able to refinance their loans anyway, so it didn't really matter that they were on shaky financial ground when they took the mortgage out. It was all going to be fine in the end. Unfortunately, the mathematical models they were using to try and make those guesses about what the future would be turned out to be flawed. They depended upon the future turning out to be exactly like the past, and they depended upon the housing market always going up.
And when the housing market doesn't go up anymore, then the whole thing falls apart. But what are the reasons why the housing market stops going up? I mean, it is in turn related to this whole set of lending practices, is it not?
Well, it's more related to the thing we opened the discussion with. If the cost of a house just begins to get so far away from what your annual income is, then you're not going to be able to bid that house higher. You're just simply going to be unable to borrow enough money to make the payments that you need to be able to buy that house. And so that's what we saw at the end of the housing boom, was this detachment from reality, this detachment from ability to pay, these inflated values that were so far away from what people's annual incomes were that they were never going to be able to get the kind of loans they needed. And so that's where the housing boom burst. And you know what? Historically, that's what's happened every time. It's happened all over the world. We've had it in the UK 3 or 4 times. We had a big example in Australia a couple of decades ago. Every study of the housing market shows this, that there's a certain equilibrium price for houses related to incomes. Once you start to get away from that equilibrium, eventually the bubble is going to burst because it just becomes unsustainable.
We're talking to Mark Gilbert, author of the book Complicit: How Greed and Collusion Made the Credit Crisis Unstoppable. So what have other countries done to minimize the damage or even possibly prevent that kind of bursting bubble and the damage that comes with it?
Well, what we're going to see next, I think, is much more government involvement in setting lending standards, in dictating things like what level of income is required for a certain kind of loan, how much money an institution has to have set aside to be able to guard against non-payment by delinquent borrowers who've overstretched themselves and won't be able to make their payments. You know, houses, if you think about a house, it's the most expensive thing most people buy in their lives, and it's where you shelter. It's a very important part of society. It's part of the fabric of how we live. And so the idea that the financial industry can get involved in this and sort of make loans that people can't afford and people end up having their houses repossessed, it's a terrible human tragedy. you know, we talk in big numbers and we talk in jargon in finance, but at the end of the day, it's people's houses that you're talking about. It's their homes. It's where they live. And so I think we will see more government involvement in setting loan standards, in circumscribing rules that don't allow lenders to take business that they shouldn't be taking, don't allow them to seduce those last 3, 4, 5% of people who are not economically stable enough to own a house through no fault of their own, but that we'll see new rules that limit the ability of the mortgage companies to pull people into home ownership when it's not really suited for them.
Are there any places where those kinds of safeguards are already in place?
Well, there are many places where home ownership just isn't quite the same dream as it is, particularly for the UK and for the US. And a lot of places depend much more on basically institutional ownership of the housing stock, where people rent a lot more. And also a lot more places with more social housing, so that the government owns the stock of residential properties, and so you're basically renting off the state. But, you know, looser loan standards, it's something quite new. It wasn't something we'd really seen very often before, certainly not to the extent that we saw during the housing boom. And one of the contributing factors to that was that the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the US, kept interest rates so low for so long, and money was kept so cheap, that there was a lot of liquidity in the system. And the thing with liquidity in the banking system is it tries to find a way to use itself. You want to make money efficient. And unfortunately, there was so much liquidity that it looked attractive to pump it into the housing market in the form of mortgages. And that turned out to be a huge mistake.
When you say money was cheap, that means interest rates are very low. I mean, I remember when the Fed said the interest rate to, what was it, 1% or 2%, something very small. Who gets money at that price? I know I don't.
No, but the banking industry does. And, of course, the other thing that we had at that time was you had, for the first time in economic history, you had China on the global stage as a huge manufacturing base, pumping cheap goods out to the Western world, televisions, T-shirts, everything that you buy on the high street, all at lower and lower prices than we'd ever seen before. And so because prices were kept low, the central banks felt confident in keeping interest rates low because they weren't concerned about inflation. And so they were kind of seduced into this game as well. They had a role to play. They have some of the blame to bear as well, I think. And so when they keep the cost of money ridiculously low with low interest rates, the financial industry is able to feed off that and find new ways to try and make a better return off that money. If you can borrow from the central bank at 1% and find someone to sell a mortgage to at 4%, you're making a good return on your money there. And so it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling, self-motivating action. When money is cheap, the finance industry thinks it can snow higher returns, and it gets busy, it gets more active, and it becomes more willing to lower its standards.
Another question that is very basic. What is a central bank? How does it work?
Well, the central bank is the guardian of monetary stability. In most cases these days, it has an inflation target, so it's trying to stop prices from rising, which tends to erode the value of things like your pension. It does this by setting interest rates of various maturities, which in turn controls how much growth there is in the economy. It controls how much factories can borrow for expansion, for instance. It controls how much entrepreneurs pay when they want to hire new people and they have to borrow to do that. So they're trying to steer the economy between growth that is stable, and you don't want too fast a growth rate, otherwise you get inflation. They're trying to maintain employment levels for the most part, because you do want the majority of your population to have a job, which in turn helps your growth rates. They're typically unelected. They're typically appointed. They're quite often professors, so they've been in academics. So in theory, they know a lot about economics. Now, unfortunately, in my view, that means they don't know a lot about the real world and practicalities. They typically never run a business. They've never had to meet payroll on a Friday. They've never had to hire and fire workers in a downturn or during a boom. But they are charged with trying to be guardians of monetary stability, trying to keep everything on an even keel so that the future is not too unpredictable, so that we can all save with some confidence in what our costs are going to be in the future, and hopefully all have jobs and houses along the way.
So if I'm a central bank, and I'm lending another bank on Wall Street money at 1 or 2%, where did I get the money to lend them?
Well, you own reserves. You know, the country as a whole has its national wealth, and that national wealth resides with the central bank. And so it's providing liquidity on an ongoing basis. It's also taking money out of the system. So there's a continuous churn of the money in the system from those who need it to those who, from those who have it to those who need it through the mechanism of the central bank.
So let's go back to these derivatives, because one of the things that you cover in your book, Complicit, How Greed and Collusion Made the Credit Crisis Unstoppable, we're talking to Mark Gilbert, is the problem of ratings. Some of these investments that were based on very bad mortgage lending practices were given AAA ratings, the very highest ratings. How did that happen? Tell us that whole story.
Well, I can give you an analogy as well that sort of shows what went wrong with that. If you're going to go out to a restaurant for dinner at the weekend and you want to go and look up the review guides and see how many stars it's got, how many people have reviewed it, what they said about the food, if you then found out that the restaurants were paying for those reviews, you might think twice about choosing a particular restaurant. And unfortunately, what had happened in the finance industry was the rating companies had ended up with a system whereby they were charging the people who made the things they were rating for the right to do that grading process. And there was back and forth. There was a feedback mechanism. So again, it's a little bit like a reviewer going to the restaurant and saying, you know what, if you just had a little bit more pepper in all those main dishes, I'd give you 4 stars instead of 3. But lo and behold, the chef puts a little bit more pepper in, and you end up with 4 stars rather than 3. What happened in the world of finance was this back and forth between the people creating the derivative securities and the people who should have been assaying them with an independent mind. And instead, that independence got lost because there was so much money to be made, there were so many of these things being created, that it was in everyone's interests to give as high a grade as they could. Again, a bit like a restaurant industry that knows it wants to get things on seats, and a restaurant reviewer who wants to sell copies of their restaurant books. So there was this collusion that went on between the people who graded the securities and the people who were inventing them to try and sell them on, which was at the heart of a lot of the problems that we saw during the credit crisis.
To use the restaurant review analogy, if the restaurant reviewer gives a restaurant 5 stars and they're selling really bad food, eventually it's going to come back to them. And same with these securities that were rated at AAA and that were bad.
Exactly, but it can take several years for that to become apparent, and that's partly what it was. If you had this box of mortgages, then the ones that were going to go rotten were going to take a little while before people weren't going to be able to afford them. And so that's what we saw. You saw these securities, these derivatives that were tied to the value of mortgages. For a while, it all looked fine. They looked like AAA. They looked like they were worth their 5-star review. It was only when they started being digested that you eventually learned that what was at the core of them was rotten and was going to be bad for you.
People are talking a lot about regulation and the need for more regulation of the financial industry. There were also regulations that existed and that were not enforced. Tell us about that.
Well, the regulators were always trying to play catch-up, unfortunately. They didn't have the quality of staff that they needed because the sort of brighter people were going into the bank themselves. They weren't going to join the regulators and be civil servants. And those regulations that we had in place, the banks had spent a lot of time lobbying to dismantle them. They used a form of blackmail. They went to the governments and said, listen, if you put obstacles in our way, then not only will your growth suffer, but there's a chance that we'll go to the country next door instead. We'll go and move ourselves, and we'll benefit their economy instead of your economy. So we think it really would be in everyone's interests if you relax the rules for us, because it'll be good for everyone. And that story was very convincing for a long time. And so what few rules there were had got weaker and weaker and looser and looser. One of the things that finance is good at is finding loopholes, finding ways around the rules. It's sort of its raison d'etre, if you like. It tries to exploit inefficiencies in markets. And in the same way, it tries to exploit inefficiencies in regulation and find the loopholes, find the little back doors that are going to let it do the kind of things it wants to do. And the regulators were just, I think, a little bit asleep at the wheel. They weren't really on the ball. They didn't have the talents. They could never quite keep up with the pace of innovation of the finance industry. And so at the end of the day, they failed us. And I think they carry a lot of the blame for what went wrong.
I mean, it seems, again, to understand this, and your book is full of analogies, you need analogies to real things. So it's kind of like somebody saying, I don't want guardrails on the side of the road because that will limit my sense of freedom when I drive my motorcycle. But if I drive over a cliff and break every bone in my body, I want a team of the best surgeons in the world to fix me up.
And that's kind of where we ended up. The banks were taking a lot of private risks. So they were using borrowed money and making bigger and bigger bets to try and get bigger and bigger bonuses. And then when it went wrong, those were turned into private liabilities. It's taxpayers' money that's been keeping the finance system afloat, even today. And so one of the issues that governments are going to have to face is this issue of too big to fail. What do you do about financial institutions that are so big and so risky that when they do collapse, you have to bail them out because otherwise you risk an economic depression? You don't want to be in that situation. No government wants to be handing taxpayers' money over to the finance industry. And so one of the battles that's going to have to come up in the next few months is how do you curb the natural enthusiasm of the banking industry to get bigger and bigger, more and more complicated and riskier? How do you build those guardrails on the side of the road so that you don't have to be the one that sends the expensive ambulances in when the inevitable crash happens?
And it is at base really hypocritical because they want of a free market until it doesn't work for them anymore, and then they want all the government help in the world.
Exactly that. Everyone believes in capitalism until they need socialism to help them out, and that's certainly where we are at the moment, I think. The worrying aspect of the crisis is you haven't seen much of an apology. There hasn't been really a recognition on the part of the finance chiefs that their behavior was at fault here, that their activities, their recklessness, is what's got us into this mess. And also no sort of sense of an apology to the taxpayer for having to rely upon taxpayer funds to stay afloat. I think it would be a much healthier situation if we saw some contriteness on the part of the finance industry, a recognition that behavior needs to change in the future, and a willingness to accept that rules are going to have to be stricter, legislation is going to have to come in, and bonus culture is going to have to change. The way people reward themselves is going to have to be more aligned with the risks they're taking and with clawback mechanisms, so that if it turns out that the bet you made wasn't as good as it first appeared, then 2, 3, 4 years down the line, you should have to give some of that bonus back.
We're talking to Mark Gilbert of Bloomberg News about his book, Complicit. What would have happened if we'd let the free market be truly free, let these huge institutions fail, and then bail out the people who had investments in these irresponsible companies, both mortgage holders and other investors, you know, widows and orphans, as you say. What would have happened then? I mean, it seems to me that when you bail out these big banks, you're basically partly paying gigantic salaries instead of paying off what amount to a relatively low number of actual investments that people would otherwise have lost.
Well, one of the bad things that happened during the credit crisis was when it became apparent that a lot of institutions were in trouble, you would have hoped that they'd have sort of circled the wagons. They'd have said, right, we're all in this together. We need to find a common solution, a private solution. We need to start helping each other out here. Instead, you saw banks turn into cannibals, with the slightly stronger banks looking at the weaker banks and thinking, hey, if I push you off the cliff, I can win your market share. So I'm going to push you off the cliff. If we'd have been in a situation, ideally, you'd have let some of the smaller firms go bust, because that would have forced the bigger firms to act in cohesion, to sort of come up with a collaborative plan for the industry as a whole, instead of the cannibalism that we saw. Unfortunately, the crisis accelerated so quickly where Bear Stearns happened almost overnight, and the government decided it needed to put $29 billion in to prevent Bear Stearns from falling off the cliff. And then it let Lehman Brothers go bust, and then within almost hours it turned out that AIG was in an even worse situation and was threatening to destroy the whole economy. So you're absolutely right. In an ideal situation, you let some of the small ones go bust, and that teaches the others a lesson. and they very quickly have to change their behavior and start banding together and come up with their own solutions. What happened in practice was that policymakers were making it up as they went along because things accelerated so quickly, firms were going bust so fast, they didn't really have time to formulate a proper Darwinistic plan that would have met the tenets of a free market and would have taught the banks a lesson while at the same time not endangering the rest of us with the prospect of economic depression and widespread terrible joblessness.
But what about the question of if you had bailed out the actual mortgage holders and ordinary person investors, could you have prevented depression in that way?
Well, it would be a very difficult thing to go to, let's say, those 5% of people who bought houses and weren't economically stable enough to afford their mortgages, and to say to just that one group of people, hey, we're the government, we're here to help, we're going to pay your mortgage for you. Because if you take one street of 100 houses, if you're going to help out five people, then what's wrong with the other 95 people? Why don't they have the same right to the same kind of help as well? So it's not really a good... it wouldn't be good policy to be going and trying to bail that out. Now, there's a lot of assistance schemes in place which are designed to stop the very worst effects of the mortgage crisis from hurting too many people. But as a response to what was happening in the markets, I don't think going and bailing out those mortgage holders would have been a better solution, and it certainly wouldn't have led to a better outcome.
The title of your book is Complicit, and the subtitle includes the word greed and collusion. And I was wondering if you could tell us about the culture of collusion and what is the nature of that culture? I mean, is it pure and simple greed? Is it a gentleman's club of people from the same universities and business schools who are watching out for each other? What's going on?
I think it's something deeper than that. I think it's within the DNA of banking. It's an aggressive culture. It's a profit-seeking culture. It's an innovation culture. And so it doesn't tend to like having strictures placed upon its behavior. The finance industry, throughout history, throughout centuries of history, has been the place where rules get bent, loopholes get found, back doors get opened. And so I think that the collusion bit that we saw was the back and forth between regulators and politicians and the finance industry. The finance industry was basically saying to government, look, we're contributing massively to your economic success. And don't forget, we had a decade-long boom of almost perfect prosperity in many parts of the world where we saw a rising tide that was lifting all boats in a way that we'd never seen before. We'd seen, again, house ownership was rising, which is, in theory, a good thing. We'd seen unemployment disappearing. We'd seen no inflation to speak of, so nothing that was going to destroy the value of future pensions. So the world looked very rosy, and the finance industry was able to say, hey, we contributed a lot to that. We are making this work. You need to leave us alone. Let us get on with our business. Don't interfere with us. Don't meddle in our affairs. And we'll continue to contribute these fantastic growth rates to the global economy. So it was a very seductive story, and one that the governments and the regulators fell for, I think. And so there was, that, in that sense, there was collusion. It was in everyone's interest to turn a blind eye to some of the excesses that were happening, to some of the ways bonuses were being paid, for example, because, hey, everyone was benefiting from these fantastic economic boom times.
There's another thing going on, which is the demand for and promise of high short-term gains. And it seems like, you know, either you offer short-term gain at a high risk or long-term gain at a low risk. You know, you get a lower rate of return, but it's steady. But it seems like, were they really trying to sell it as if it were a low-risk investment? I mean, was that part of the whole problem?
Well, if you think of your average saver, particularly in somewhere like America, where you have a choice of money market funds, where you can put money aside, in a low inflation environment, interest rates are low and the returns are low, it gets a little bit too seductive to go for something a bit riskier. So what you saw was money market funds that were offering lower returns versus more exotic funds that offered enhanced returns. Now, the average consumer didn't read the small print, didn't make the connection. Gee, how are they making those higher returns? Well, it turns out they were doing it with extra risk. So instead of your money being safely put away in a money market fund, sleeping in a vault, waiting for the day when you needed to draw upon it, your money was off in an enhanced fund, having the time of its life, high on finance in the global casinos. That's how the high returns were being made. Now, unfortunately, this is the sense in which we were all a little bit guilty of complicity. We wanted those higher returns. We were willing to put our business with money market funds that offered us an enhanced return. Well, guess what? We were taking on bigger risks to do that. And so we were going to... You take on bigger risks, and the potential downside is there. The potential for loss is greater than if you take a safer return. So one of the ways in which I think we need to move forward is we need to ask ourselves, what kind of institutions do I want to do business with? Where do I want my money to be? How safe do I want my money to be? What is my appetite for risk? We all got a little bit seduced into thinking, well, if returns are low, maybe I should just chase down a little bit of extra return. Maybe I should chase down a bit of extra yield and take on a different kind of fund without really saying to ourselves, honestly, you only get a higher return if you take a bigger risk, and am I really willing to take those risks?
Now, you were warning about an impending crisis for about a year and a half before this meltdown actually happened. What did you see as warning signs? I mean, was it like 1928?
Well, we watch the price of money every minute of every hour of every day. That's kind of what we do. And we are no better at predicting the future than anybody else. You just really can't do it. But one of the things that we do think we're quite good at is spotting when things are moving out of line with historical norms, spotting when markets are pricing for perfection, i.e. they're anticipating absolutely nothing going wrong. We're good at spotting when everyone is expecting the future to be identical to the past. And we're also pretty good at spotting when you've got herd behavior, when you've got everyone moving in the same direction. You know, I have a friend who does heavy metal music, and he says the way that you mix a heavy metal record is you make everything louder than everything else. Well, one of the things we were seeing in markets at that time was that everything was louder than everything else. Everything was rising in price faster than everything else. That just doesn't make sense. Different markets should move at different speeds. They should react to different parts of the economy in different ways. And some things should rise at the same time as other things are falling. That wasn't what we were seeing. We were seeing a global bubble in just about everything that you could buy and sell. Fine wines, art, houses, yachts, exotic sports cars, watches, everything was all racing to the top. And that to us was just an alarm bell that things have gone out of hand and we're unhinged from reality.
You know, there's a quotation in your book that I found fascinating from Karl Marx, Das Kapital, 1867. And I'm going to read it out loud. Owners of capital will stimulate the working class to buy more and more expensive goods, houses, and technology, pushing them to take more and more expensive credit until their debt becomes unbearable. The unpaid debt will lead to the bankruptcy of banks, which will then have to be nationalized, and the state will have to take the road, which will eventually lead to communism. It's unbelievable to me how applicable that is to the current situation. I mean, erase the word communism, but insert bailout.
Well, you know, the thing with the history of finance is we've been here before, boom, followed by bust, followed by boom, followed by bust. Overreaching behavior always tends to lead to excesses, and those in turn lead to collapses in markets. So there's nothing new in what we're seeing. The scale of it is definitely new. The globalization of it is new this time around. But anyone who's studied the history of markets knows that, you know, you get these crazes, you get these unhinged moments, and it always turns out badly. You know, some of the quotations in the book, yes, I quote Marx, but I also quote Bob Dylan and the Pope as well. The finance itself is well documented in its history of creating massive speculative bursts, which then go sour and you know, threaten to take down the world, in effect.
So where are we now? We've given this bailout, and actually I'd like to ask you, what the terms of that bailout were. Was the money handed out as gifts or loans? Was that money repaid? Is it being repaid?
Big chunks of it are being repaid. The banks are making enough profit now that they can afford to pay back some of the help that they've been given. But the system as a whole is still very dependent upon taxpayers' money. The terms that it was given on, well, it was given a high rate of interest, but again, that's what you'd expect in an emergency situation. And I think it will be repaid. The taxpayer may even make a profit on it. The taxpayer may end up making some money via the government on what they've lent to the finance industry. But yes, it will be repaid. Where we are now, we're back to than we could have been. I mean, a year ago, there were still people who were talking about a Great Depression again. There were people talking about the economy absolutely collapsing. At the moment, we seem to be in pretty good shape, certainly versus where we might have expected to be. The difficult bit's going to be as all of that liquidity gets withdrawn, as some of those stimulus packages start to unwind, as the patient is taken off the life support machine, can we avoid a relapse? Can we avoid what's called a double-dip recession? And we've never had an experiment like this before. We've never seen this in the world of economics, in the world of finance. And so it's slightly worrying to see what will happen next, whether the central banks and the governments, once they take away the safety net, once they take away these massive injections of money and liquidity, whether the patient will be able to stand on his or her own 2 feet and sort of be walking and talking and healthy. That's not clear to us yet.
It does seem that a good deal of this could be solved with a little bit more humility and moderation. I mean, we talk about the financial service industry, and it'd be nice to put the sense of service back into it in some way, that you are financing real people, real things, companies making things that are actually valuable.
You know, that's definitely true, and it's one of the problems about what happened during the credit boom is that the banking industry got out of its box. Instead of servicing the wider economy, instead of being an avenue for entrepreneurs to be able to finance their dreams, for companies to be able to expand, for trade to become more global, finance started finding ways of just serving itself, of basically inventing risk purely for trading purposes, to make a profit, to make a fee, to be able to generate bigger and bigger bonuses, to generate more trading activity. And definitely one of the things that I think we need to see a return of is that finance becomes a servant of the wider economy. It becomes a means to an end, not an end in itself, and starts to, again, service the real economy where jobs are created, you know, where goods are made, where services are traded, where intellectual property gets employed. I think that's definitely one of the features that we saw in the past 10 years of finance becoming too big for its boots. And so I sincerely hope that we start to see a reversal of that trend and that it manages to be restrained into something that just helps the wider economy.
I was thinking about, when I was reading your book, about people talk about how taxes are too high, we're overly taxed, and that's debatable and you can talk about it forever. But I'm looking at this situation and the upward flow of money. So an ordinary person takes out a mortgage, and maybe it's a subprime mortgage, which they do their best to repay, or maybe a regular mortgage. And then their mortgage checks are going not only toward the mortgage and, you know, the house itself and the interest, but all these fees and points and basically money that feeds this greedy and arrogant class of people who are much wealthier than any of the people most of the people paying mortgages. And it ends up becoming a kind of virtual tax on homeownership. Only instead of the government getting it and providing some services, it goes to this wealthy class that gives nothing back and doesn't even think about the roots of where they got their dollars in the first place.
Well, certainly any time you have more middlemen involved, all trying to take their slice, then you are going to end up with a less efficient system. And as you rightly say, a kind of tax on the transaction. One of the things that I think is interesting at the moment is this groundswell of support for more community-based banking, whereby you should know the people you're lending to as a banking institution. So instead of centralized decisions from some headquarters in some anonymous part of the country, you start to have local banks with local bank managers making local decisions based upon the people they know, based upon the communities that they're trying to serve, with a proper insight into the local economy, into the ability of local people to borrow money, both for houses and for businesses. And I think that that's going to be an interesting development going forward. I think that, you know, the banks have managed to arouse so much anger that the big banks will find that a lot of their customers will start to think more about moving their business to smaller, more regional banks. and that those regional banks in turn will be in a better position to judge the risks of the loans they're making, and that should in turn make them more profitable. They should be able to do business better than the bigger banks can. Certainly here in the UK, we're seeing some new entrants on the banking scene, some new competition from institutions who are saying, hey, we're going to let our local bank manager make the decisions about who gets the money, because they're going to be in the best position to judge what the local community needs, but also to judge what kind of return we can make and how safe our loans can be. And if that starts to happen on a grassroots basis, if we all start to think a little bit harder about who we do business with, what kind of ethical values we want to support, then I think you would end up with a healthier banking system and one that does service the community more and does serve the real economy.
And the motivation for that would come from what? From borrowers? From a grassroots movement? Or what?
Well, it comes from two sides. One is it comes from me and you choosing who we do business with. So instead of some anonymous behemoth bank, we choose to go to our local institution. That's where we put our deposits. That's who we decide to have our checking accounts with. And that's who we decide to borrow from if we do decide to buy a house. So that's one side of the equation. On the other side of the equation, I think some banks are recognizing that it's better business to let the people on the ground make the banking decisions about who you lend money to and who you're going to entrust that money with. And so I think that what we're starting to see from banks, certainly in the UK, and also I hear some of the community banks in the US as well, is that that just makes better sense. You can have a more stable business and a more profitable business by having the people on the ground make those kind of decisions. Take it away from the headquarters and put it down in the communities where the real economy actually happens, where you can judge the risks better, where you have a sense of some skin in the game, where you have something at risk, which is going to make you make better lending decisions, certainly better decisions than we saw in the height of the credit boom.
Now, do you see any promising legislation on the horizon, and do you see any changes in the culture of the banking industry?
Well, I think President Obama's speech last week was very, very heartening. I think some of the things he touched on, the idea of not being held hostage by the finance industry in the future, by the idea that you shouldn't have institutions that are too big to fail, by the idea that if you're going to be a bank and you're going to take people's deposits and their nest eggs and their savings, then you shouldn't be allowed to go and do proprietary trading that risks everything that's in your bank. I think those are all very, very positive signs for the future. I do think that all of the mood music that we're hearing from governments and regulators around the world is that they're ready to act, that they're going to kind of grasp the nettle. They've found their spines. They know that action needs to be taken. They're going to stop listening to the siren song of the lobbyists on behalf of the banks, and they're going to put proper rules in place that ensure that we never again have to risk taxpayers' money to bail out the finance industry.
Mark Gilbert is the author of the book Complicit: How Greed and Collusion Made the Credit Crisis Unstoppable. He's bureau chief for Bloomberg News in London. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it a lot.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience, broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao. Thank you.